of money that he has spent. He's increasing in name recognition. You see that by the poll numbers.
And Finney is right. As Bloomberg has spent money, you've seen a slow, steady increase in his poll numbers. He's now averaging around 5% nationally, and that's higher than many Democrats who entered this race long before him. Bloomberg has proved that he can finance his own election and win. He did that as mayor of New York City. But Democratic pollster Anna Greenberg says it's not easy, especially in a Democratic primary.
Self-funders can win elections, but it's always challenging for them. And there's a kind of perception that you're trying to buy the election, which is quite problematic for some voters. I mean, it's less about someone being a billionaire and more about the idea that they're trying to sort of buy it.
Greenberg is not discounting the importance of money. In fact, she says when she's worked in primaries where nobody really knows any of the candidates, the person who spent the most money has won. But this Democratic presidential primary is different. People are already plugged into the race.
You have a lot of candidates that are well known. You have a lot of very engaged voters following the primary. Somebody coming in with money can't really, it's not a blank slate. People already have ideas of who they support. And so it's just much harder for that money to have influence.
Bloomberg's money strategy is not just about advertising. It's also about hiring, especially in the states that will vote right after those initial primaries. Here's Karen Finney again.
The recent announcement that he's added 200 staffers on the ground in a number of the March Super Tuesday states, it changes the calculation a little bit for the candidates who are currently in.
Bloomberg's strategy is based on the assumption that Democratic voters are anxious and not rallying around any single candidate. And his campaign thinks he has a path if no candidate emerges as a clear favorite after the first few states vote.
You don't need to have early primary states. He's got a network all across the country right now. What he has done, nobody has been able to match.
That's Steve Williams, the mayor of Huntington, West Virginia. That network he's referring to, it's mayors all across the country, mayors who trust Bloomberg and feel indebted to him because they've received millions of dollars in grants to build art centers or fight climate change. After Bloomberg left office, he leveraged his personal fortune into helping other cities. Earlier this month, Williams endorsed Bloomberg, whose foundation gave his city assistance related to the opioid epidemic.
Somebody helps you, you help them. And it's amazing how our city has benefited because of Mayor Bloomberg's support.
These mayors say it's not just about the money. It's about witnessing Bloomberg's expertise and judgment firsthand. Bloomberg is essentially running a general election campaign in the primaries. Earlier this week, he launched a digital ad depicting Democratic voters in battleground states, warning that Trump could win re-election.
We need to wake up. In Michigan, the only one campaigning here is Donald Trump.
As a Pennsylvania, I understand there's a caucus in Iowa, but what about here?
Michael Nutter, the former mayor of Philadelphia, recently endorsed Bloomberg and is now serving as his national political chair. And he says this general election outreach is part of their strategy.
We're going to places where Democrats, for the most part, are not going right now, where we have to win in order to win the White House in 2020.
He points to his home state.
Pennsylvania doesn't vote until April, but there's an office now open in Philadelphia, and there'll be others in Pennsylvania way before.
Okay, so Asma, Bloomberg is basically trying to address the central question for Democrats, which is, who is the person who can beat President Trump?
Yes, and, you know, as we have heard, campaigning in battleground states is a key part of it, but so is money. The Trump campaign and the Republican Party have raised $300 million from January through September, and we're going to get new fundraising numbers soon that will include the last 3 months, which was the time period of Trump's impeachment battle, so it's likely that, you know, those new numbers are going to be substantially higher. But in essence, Bloomberg's theory is that President Trump has buckets of money to spend, and Democrats need to be able to compete with that.
And Beers Aspen Khalid, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right. The president recently signed a $738 billion defense bill. This is a bill that had wide bipartisan support. What's striking about that is not just the bipartisan part, but that it included funding that launches a new branch of the military, the U.S. Space Force. Space, cybersecurity, these are part of new threat assessments. Times are changing, and that includes in our reserve military forces. Here's more from Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce.
Before we talk about this next big evolution in the National Guard, let's talk about the last one.
9/11.
That's historian Ann Armstrong.
director of the National Guard Memorial Museum, Library, and Archive.
In the decades before September 11th, when people thought of the National Guard, Armstrong says they pictured job duties like
stuffing sandbags for a river flood in the local community.
The National Guard was just that, national, serving in the American homeland. After 9/11, recruitment exploded, except the Guard wasn't looking to keep those recruits at home.
Next thing they know, they're on a C-5 on their way over to Afghanistan.
9/11 was the catalyst for something the Department of Defense had been slowly inching toward for a long time. The goal was to train National Guard soldiers and make them essentially interchangeable with any other battle-ready soldier. Over the last 18 years, from 9/11 on, that's really come to fruition.
The National Guard has become more like the active duty than ever in the history of the National Guard.
But now comes a new pivot. This past summer, the annual National Guard Association of the U.S. conference was held in Denver.
On Wisconsin.
Guard members came in from the states and territories.
The National Guard Association of Mississippi.
Over the several-day conference, top military officials struck a recurring theme. Counterterrorism is a fading priority. Competition with other world powers like Russia and China is on the rise, and the importance of technology right along with it. Here's Air Force Vice Chief of Staff General Stephen Wilson telling the crowd about the modern threat from China.
Last year, they graduated 8 times the number of STEM graduates that we did.
8 times the people earning science and technology degrees.
And we have to stop thinking like we're Goliath and start thinking now like we're David.
The military is looking for a lot more people with skills in tech, and for the Guard in particular, looking to the private sector.
I commute to Los Angeles and usually fly 3 to 4 Delta Airlines trips a month.
James Riemann lives in Denver and flies big commercial jets for his day job.
And then in between, I'll serve for the Air National Guard, and I usually average between 4 to 10 days a month.
Riemann commands soldiers who focus above the atmosphere, the Colorado Guard's 138th Space Control Squadron. About half of the National Guard's space personnel are based in Colorado. The state's also a likely location for many of the increased space resources sought by the Trump administration. Riemann was brought in to instill the warrior's mindset he learned as a former fighter pilot in his new soldiers, who spend most of their time tied to a desk and computer.
To kind of help these space warfighters, as we call them, realize they're not a support function anymore. They're at the leading edge. They're warfighters. They're relevant.
Even more relevant because of their non-military day jobs. Riemann reports to Colonel Micah Fessler. Fessler says the military is realizing more and more it needs to leverage the innovations from private companies, especially in the space and cybersecurity realms.
We can take advantage of their expertise on the outside and use that on the inside.
And here, the Guard might have a leg up over regular military service. The country's top space and cybersecurity talent may not want to leave their lucrative full-time private sector jobs. The Guard gives those high-end professionals another option for military service.
Thank you.
Back at last summer's conference, Air Force Vice Chief Stephen Wilson told the gathered Guardsmen the Pentagon knows how valuable they are.
Never before in our nation's history will our nation rely on our National Guard like they do today.
He then said the National Guard provides 40% of the Air Force's offensive space capability, a percentage they plan to grow significantly in the next few years. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Colorado Springs.
This is NPR News.
19 past 8 now. You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR on this Friday. And coming up, the final Wisconsin Life of 2019. Just in time for Hanukkah, a story about religion, Yiddish folk music, and family. That's on the way in 25 minutes.
Celebrate the season with special programs on Wisconsin Public Radio all this month. Enjoy festive music from Simply Folk, Christmas music from the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs, and the annual New Year's Concert from Vienna. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Security Health Plan, dedicated to providing health plans and neighborly support to help employers of all sizes achieve their goals. More about plan options is at securityhealth.org.
There are moments in life where we all must rise, where we all must answer the call. Join me, Austin Brandt.
And me, Tim Williamson.
On a new podcast from WGTD and Gateway.
Where we highlight the tremendous sacrifices of emergency medical personnel. Subscribe to The Call, now on Apple and Google Podcasts.
We're expecting cloudy skies this morning around the state, but it'll clear off later in the day, highs in the 30s. Saturday, rain likely in the south, a wintry mix in central Wisconsin, and then snow in the north, possibly with a few inches of accumulation. Windy, highs from the upper 40s in the south to the low 30s in the north. And rain in south and central Wisconsin on Sunday, a mix of rain and snow in the north, continued windy, highs in the 50s in the south, the 40s in the middle of the state, and the 30s in the north.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And from Doctors Without Borders, whose teams are committed to confronting challenges in conflict and crisis zones to provide access to health care for people in need. More information at doctorswithoutborders.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Ukraine has announced that it is buying more Javelin anti-tank missiles from the United States. This military purchase comes at a time when Ukraine is trying to smooth over relations following the impeachment of President Trump. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Back in that infamous July phone call, Ukraine's new president said he was almost ready to buy more Javelins from the U.S. President Trump responded, saying, quote, "I would like you to do us a favor, though." Trump has since been impeached. He had been holding up U.S. aid to Ukraine, releasing it only after a whistleblower complaint came to the attention of Congress. Soon after, he was meeting Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, in New York, touting his earlier assistance.
"I gave you anti-tank busters that, frankly, President Obama was sending you pillows and sheets. And I gave you anti-tank busters. And a lot of people didn't want to do that, but I did it."
Now Ukraine is buying Javelins with its own money. It sees these weapons as a deterrent to Russia. Ukraine's embassy says in a statement, quote, "We are proud that Ukraine is becoming a reliable partner of the United States, eligible to procure high-tech U.S. defense products." The Ukrainian ambassador in a tweet also writes that he's looking forward to a visit to Kyiv in early January by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. That would send an important signal, according to Stephen Pfeiffer, a former U.S. ambassador.
"When I was in Kyiv about 7 weeks ago, there was a degree of nervousness about the depth of the U.S.-Ukraine relationship. And what the Ukrainians will be looking for is basically a signal from Secretary Pompeo that the United States' support is there in full."
But Pfeiffer says it was not helpful to have Trump's private lawyer Rudy Giuliani in Kyiv recently, meeting with a discredited former prosecutor and other unsavory characters.
"It's worrisome because the president seems still to listen to Mr. Giuliani and sometimes maybe paying more attention to Mr. Giuliani than he does to his own State Department, his embassy in Kyiv, his National Security Council staff, or his intelligence community. And that's a problem."
Pfeiffer is also troubled by the planned departure of the current acting ambassador in Ukraine. Bill Taylor testified in the impeachment hearings. Now he's been asked to hand off to the deputy chief of mission on New Year's Day. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Music.
Banishment is a rare but serious form of punishment in Indian country. People can lose their homes, their jobs, they can't enter the reservation. It mostly happens to violent offenders or drug dealers. But on one reservation in Utah, some tribal members are suing in federal court because they say they were banished for more political reasons. Nate Hedgie from member station KUER in Salt Lake City has the story.
Angelina Chigup and three other women are eating chips and salsa at a Mexican restaurant in Roosevelt, Utah. They seem happy right now, but Chigup says this past year has been hard. Ever since she and the others were banished from the Uinta and Ouray Indian Reservation by the Ute tribe.
It changed our lives. One moment I had a job, the next moment I didn't.
Chigup says the banishment forced her into an early retirement from her job as a grant coordinator for the tribe. She still retains tribal membership, but says she lost her health and life insurance that she got through her job. Now, unless Chigup has a police escort, she can't attend traditional ceremonies on reservation lands or visit friends and family, even when a few of those friends and family members passed away.
Couldn't attend the funeral because of what the council decided.
Chigup says she and the other women were banished by tribal leadership because they were trying to bring history to light. The women say they are from two earlier bands of indigenous people who lived here before the federally recognized Ute tribe even existed. And here's the claim that eventually led to their banishment. The women believe they have 19th century treaty rights to an oil-rich part of the reservation.
We've been bringing this issue out to where, hey, we all need to know our history here.
If these claims are true, it means that these women would have control over that part of the reservation and the oil and gas beneath it. Ute tribal leadership declined to be interviewed, but in court documents, leadership claimed the women were trying to destabilize its government. They interfered in ongoing litigation pertaining to the tribe, and leadership called those court filings frivolous and nonsensical and said it cost them millions of dollars. Eventually, the tribe banished the four women, including Tara Ambo. She says banishment is like public shaming.
We'll walk into a grocery store and we'll get the look, you know, from people. But yeah, it takes your liberty, your freedom. And all we were doing was just freedom of speech, you know.
After the women were banished, they sued the tribe in Utah's federal district court, arguing they weren't given due process and that the banishment was a violation of their civil rights. But the judge dismissed the case. He wrote, in part, that federal courts can't intervene because tribes are sovereign nations. Grant Christensen is an Indian law professor at the University of North Dakota. He explains that this is a matter of jurisdiction.
Tribes are their own governments, separate from states and separate from the United States.
Christensen says tribes aren't beholden to the U.S. Bill of Rights. Congress tried to build a workaround in 1968.
Called the Indian Civil Rights Act. That extends most, but not all, of our constitutional protections onto tribal governments.
But here's the thing. Enforcement of that 1968 law has been mostly struck down by the courts because, again, tribes are sovereign nations. However, there is an exception. Federal courts are allowed to intervene if someone is unlawfully detained by a tribe.
And so in that context, banishment runs into this interesting gray area in the law.
The federal courts are currently split over whether banishment is a form of unlawful detention. If the Tenth Circuit decides to hear this case, Christensen says it could set up a fight that ends in the Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Nate Hedgie in Roosevelt, Utah.
And Nate's story came to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. This afternoon on All Things Considered, Amazon warehouse workers get injured more than the industry average. We talked to a former Amazon employee in Salt Lake City. To listen, ask your smart speaker to play NPR or ask for your member station by name. This is NPR News.
After an ordinary Chinese citizen had his personal information leaked online, he began campaigning for Beijing to create stronger privacy protections for consumers.
Data leakage is sunk into every corner of your life.
I'm Elsa Chang, digital privacy in China's surveillance state, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered. That starts at 4 this afternoon, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning edition on WPR. In state news, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has received an anonymous $10 million donation towards a new Great Lakes research vessel. We'll hear more about that in WPR's newscast. That's in just a minute.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Winsor Johnston. Congressional leaders remain at an impasse over the makeup of President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's disturbed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's vow of total coordination with the White House. Liz Ruskin of Alaska Public Media reports Murkowski's opposition to impeachment has mostly focused on process.
It's really just in her nature to be a centrist, to seek middle ground like this. And also you'll note that she's criticizing Leader McConnell on process, and that is very important to her, sticking to procedure and tradition. That's how she rolls.
Democrats are pushing for witness testimony from top administration officials. Republicans have pushed back on that but say they haven't ruled it out. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is withholding the articles of impeachment against Trump until Republicans provide details of their plans for witnesses and testimony. The death toll from this week's typhoon in the central Philippines has risen to 28. Officials say at least 12 others are still missing. The storm brought high winds and heavy rain, destroying hundreds of homes. Tens of thousands of people remain in temporary shelters. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 67 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee received an anonymous $10 million donation towards a new research vessel. The donation came from a donor who is part of the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Rayanne McClellan Hurd is a research graduate assistant at UW-Milwaukee. She says the new vessel, named the Maggie Sue, will be a very unique ship.
It does mean a lot for the school and faculty. I think the biggest difference just comes down to space on the new vessel.
The Maggie Sue will have advanced technology, lab space, and sleeping accommodations. She will replace the Niske, the current 64-year-old research vessel. It's been a busy year for Wisconsin's largest airports. Dane County Regional Airport has seen monthly passenger traffic increase by as much as 13% in some months, according to data from the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport expects to see over 7 million arriving and departing passengers for the second year in a row. Airlines have added additional routes at both airports this year. Henry Hardevelt is president of Atmosphere Research Group, which analyzes the transportation industry. He says convincing airlines to add new flights or use larger planes for existing routes is a process that often takes years.
With airplanes that can cost upwards of $75 million, I think everyone can appreciate this decision-making has to be very thorough, and they weigh each route against others.
Hardevelt says even with recent expansion, it's possible the state could see a decline in overall flights because some national carriers are planning to cut back flights in 2020. Police in Waukesha say a Chicago man has died after being struck by a train on Tuesday. Authorities say the 33-year-old man was struck early in the morning in the Milwaukee suburb. The conductor saw the man on the tracks, but the train was unable to stop in time. Emergency crews searched for the man and found him alongside the train. He was unconscious and died later that afternoon. The accident remains under investigation. Cloudy skies this morning around the state, but clearing off later in the day. We'll have highs in the 30s. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio, and you can get more Wisconsin news at any time by going to our website. That's WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, from clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from C3.ai, C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. Let's turn now to the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan, where a commercial passenger jet crashed this morning with 98 passengers and crew on board. At least 12 people were killed, including the pilot, and many more were injured. The plane was taking off from Almaty International Airport when it went down. NPR's Lucian Kim is with us. He's been following this story from Moscow. Hi, Lucian.
Good morning.
So what do we know at this point?
Well, the airline involved is called Bek Air, which is billing itself as Kazakhstan's first low-cost carrier. The airline's website shows has scheduled service to 10 cities in Kazakhstan, which is a huge country in Central Asia. It's about four times the size of Texas. Flight 2100 was flying from Almaty, the country's largest city and commercial capital, to Nur-Sultan, the political capital 600 miles away. There were 93 passengers aboard and five crew members. One passenger told a local website that the plane took off completely normally, and then about a minute or two into the flight, there was a strong shaking. The plane continued to gain altitude and then fell. It hit the ground, struck a two-story building, and the fuselage broke apart. According to the airport, there was no fire, which may account for the low death toll. The airport has posted a list of 60 survivors on Facebook, and officials say there are 49 passengers in the hospital, 18 in critical condition.
I mean, a terrible crash, but it sounds like it could have been much worse if there had been a fire breaking out. What kind of plane was this?
The plane is a Dutch-built Fokker 100. It's a commuter jet which is no longer being manufactured. The company actually went bankrupt in 1996 because it could not compete with Boeing's 737. Bek Air, the airline, owns seven of these planes, which are still flown by airlines around the world, though no longer in the United States. This particular plane was configured for 100 passengers, so it was almost a full flight.
I know it's early, but any talk from officials of the actual cause here?
Well, the country's deputy prime minister said the cause could be pilot error or technical issues. The country's president has said that there's already a government commission investigating. And he said that, you know, all those who were at fault for this accident will be punished to the full extent of the law. Though, of course, at this point, we don't know the cause and whether any laws were violated.
I got to ask you, in this part of the world, I mean, when these type of disasters happen, their investigations, do we ever really see real change to infrastructure or anything?
Well, the short answer is no. Authorities always pledge to get to the bottom of things. But unfortunately, there's a Soviet tradition of intransparency and a lack of accountability. So we may even find out the reason why the plane crashed, but it's not clear at all that will lead to any changes.
That's NPR's Moscow correspondent Lucian Kim reporting on this plane crash this morning. The plane had just taken off from the largest city in Kazakhstan. Lucian, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, David.
The composer and lyricist Jerry Herman wrote cheerful, optimistic songs for Broadway musicals like Hello, Dolly, Mame, and La Cage aux Folles. He died last night at the age of 88. His lyrics were simple, his melodies were catchy, and critic Bob Mondello says he had one trick up his sleeve that always worked on audiences.
Remember when Pixar's animated robot WALL-E first met his mechanical soulmate Eve and took her home? To impress her, he showed her bubble wrap, a light bulb, a Rubik's Cube, and he popped in a VHS tape of a big production number from Jerry Herman's Hello, Dolly. Using a garbage can lid as a straw hat, WALL-E started dancing along with the figures on his tiny screen. He'd watched this number a lot, had picked up its choreography, and when Eve decided to join in, she did so with a little more enthusiasm than he expected. perfectly understandable that number had long been getting audiences excited, as had similar numbers in Jerry Herman shows from Milk and Honey to La Cage aux Folles. And all that cheer must have seemed irresistible to Wally, an antidote to howling windstorms, upbeat, affirmative, and with what I'd always thought of as the Jerry Herman pulse, a throb that came into what sounded at first like a sweet little song and told you it was going to build.
Open a new window.
This one's from Mame, Angela Lansbury's Auntie Mame, singing to her nephew Patrick about how he should always be up for new experiences. They're alone when the number starts. She's just singing to him. But before long, they're joined by the rest of the household, and then by Mame's neighbors, and after a couple of choruses, folks on the street, and eventually by what seems like all of New York. New Yorker Jerry Herman did write other kinds of ditties, sweet and sentimental when a love song was required, peppy for patter songs, torchy for big ballads. But as he established, especially after taking a hiatus when he had three flops in a row, this was the sort of song he owned. It didn't seem to crop up much in other writers' musicals, the cheer-up anthem that reminded audiences that for life to be okay, you just need a little Christmas in Mame, or to put a little more mascara on in La Cage, or to tap your troubles away in Mac and Mabel. In Dolly, he wrote a first act anthem for a long sidelined leading lady who decided to rejoin life. In La Cage, his leading lady was a man in drag persuading a room full of homophobes that. In Milk and Honey, Herman wrote an anthem for the new nation of Israel. And in Dear World, he tried to buck up a whole decrepit planet. And again and again, as that heartbeat in the bass line came in, Broadway audiences reveled in what was always the overriding message in a Jerry Herman show, that yes, life can come at you hard, but hold your head high, face the future, march to that pulse, because when others see your confidence, they will line up in support, filling the stage, arms in the air, singing to beat the band. I'm Bob Mandela.
This is NPR News.
Jerry Herman is a hard act to follow. Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 8:42 right now. And coming up, we'll hear about independent filmmaking brothers Josh and Benny Safdie. Their Adam Sandler thriller, Uncut Gems, is something they've been trying to make for nearly a decade. NPR's Andrew Limbong has a profile in about 9 minutes.
Tune in to PBS Wisconsin Monday night at 8 for the Wisconsin School Music Association's 2019 State Honors Concerts. Enjoy the talent of Wisconsin's finest young musicians, including band, choir, and orchestra, as they unite on the stage of Madison's Overture Hall for one of the most rewarding musical experiences of their lives. The 2019 State Honors Concerts, Monday at 8 on PBS Wisconsin.
Support for the WPR Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
Coming up on WPR, it's classical music with Stephanie Elkins, and she'll begin with a traditional Scottish tune arranged for violin and orchestra. Also this morning, a cello concerto by Franz Josef Haydn, some romances by Clara Schumann, and piano music of Robert Schumann. Classical music with Stephanie Elkins coming up here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Cloudy skies this morning around the state, but clearing off later in the day. We'll have highs in the 30s. On Saturday, rain likely in the south, a wintry mix in central Wisconsin, snow in the north, maybe a few inches of accumulation, windy, and highs from the upper 40s in the south to the low 30s in the north.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world.
8:45 now. You're listening to WPR, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about religion, music, and family, just in time for Hanukkah.
Music is a cornerstone of Jewish culture, especially during holidays and festivals. Musician Lil Rev grew up in a musical family in Milwaukee, steeped in his family's Yiddish folk music tradition. He travels the country sharing his love of music, history, and his heritage.
Well, I started playing guitar at about the age of 12, paid for a couple of lessons, and then from there went about learning from anyone I could and listening to records and trying to figure out songs like so many of us often do. My grandfather played mouth organ, and my mom sang a lot of Broadway songs, and my grandparents did a lot of old Yiddish folk music, so I did grow up around a lot of music. My dad was a huge music fan. I always was bringing home records. I remember dancing around the house, everything from the Kingston Trio to Harry Belafonte to Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, and all kind of music that my dad was listening to at the time I was subjected to. But I knew that I wasn't destined to be Ozzy Osbourne. And I had grown up with all this great folk music, like the Yiddish stuff. But, you know, when you grow up, that's just something that grandpa does. And it's not necessarily hip or cool. But as you get a little bit older, you see, I don't have to go really looking too far for a sense of authenticity, because I grew up around it. You know, my grandparents, that was about as authentic as it got. Singing songs of the old country, you know, Tum Balalaika and Oifen Pripichik and some of the classic Yiddish stuff. And, you know, if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, you know that our people are people of tradition. And I became really interested in the history of the music as much as performing it. I think to this day I enjoy the stories and the history of the music almost as much as I do interpreting a lot of it and writing my own songs as well. As I became a musician, my heroes oftentimes were my next door neighbors. There's a guy in Milwaukee named Paul Melrude who I regularly still get together with. He's in his early 90s, and his door is always open for me to come and work on old Yiddish songs with him and pronunciations and things like that. So it's a human connection that I'm drawn to more so than anything. And when I can sing a song that I actually learned from someone like that, it means a whole lot more than any tune I will have ever learned off of an old long-playing record, you know, because it's the real deal. I guess if you don't know where you came from, you know, you'll never get where you're going or something along those lines, right? I feel like one foot should always be rooted and that tradition. My grandfather, he had all these little wise sayings, and of course, most of them had Yiddish, connotations about work and work ethic and stuff like that. He'd say things like, "We've all been riding on the coattails of those who've gone down before." So I guess it's always been important to me to acknowledge the road that was blazed by those who came before, and the gratitude that we should all have for those who opened doors for us.
That story on Wisconsin musician Lil Rev was produced by Erica Janik, the former host of Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Bristol-based Creator Farms, offering fresh microgreens and petite lettuces grown even in winter. Also, wheatgrass pots and shots. Follow them on Facebook. The market is held Saturdays from 10 until 2 at the Kenosha Masonic Center.
Hip Life, Mikasa, and more with DJ Teddy. Find out more at WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks play the Atlanta Hawks tonight, coming off a Christmas Day loss to Philadelphia. Game time is 6:30. The Wisconsin men's basketball team plays Tennessee tomorrow. The women play Rutgers tomorrow. Marquette's men host the Central Arkansas Bears Saturday, and the Marquette women play DePaul on Sunday. The Packers will play the Lions on Sunday.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. The movie Uncut Gems has been getting a lot of attention, especially for Adam Sandler's performance as Howard Ratner, a New York City diamond district jeweler who, among other things, has a marriage that is falling apart.
It's because you're mad. You're mad, and it makes sense. You can punch me if you want.
Oh, thanks.
The movie has been a decade in the making, a life's work for a pair of directors who also happen to be brothers, Josh and Benny Safdie. NPR's Andrew Limbong has this on the duo's career.
Josh is the older brother.
Benny, can you switch headphones? These ones are too big.
And Benny's the younger one.
Oh, these are much better. Yours are much.
Why'd you give me terrible headphones?
They were born and raised in New York City, where most of their movies are set. Their parents were separated, and their relationship with their dad was the basis for their 2009 movie, Daddy Long Legs. It's an empathetic look at a dad who wants to be there for his two young sons more than he actually is there.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. All right, not on the floor. Not. Look.
Yeah.
Hey.
The type of dad who buys his kids hot dogs and ice cream after school but doesn't know who their principal is or how to talk to him.
Don't reprimand me in front of my children. Do not reprimand me in front of my own kids, all right?
The movie got them a lot of attention. It hit the festival circuit and the award circuit. At the Independent Spirit Awards in 2011, it earned the prestigious John Cassavetes Award. Eugene Hernandez is the deputy director of film at Lincoln Center, which runs the New York Film Festival. He was there when the brothers showed it at Cannes.
They walked out on stage with Josh sitting on his younger brother's shoulders.
He says even back then, they were some of the more unique filmmakers he'd seen.
Simply because they're so driven and focused and precise in the worlds they explore, but they're also kind of kooky.
In interviews for Daddy Long Legs, the brothers mentioned their next feature, another movie partially inspired by their dad, set in Manhattan's Diamond District called Uncut Gems. Remember, it's 2009.
Then we're hoping that it'll be our last New York movie.
But obstacles like getting access to the New York jewel trade got in the way. So they made other movies while keeping an eye on Gems. Here's Josh.
Uncut Gems was kind of this North Star project for us. It was the meta destination. It was always everything that we made in the interim was in service of making this movie.
Each movie they made brought them a little closer to Gems, deepened their skill set, brought them more clout. But those movies are more than just stepping stones. They each showcase different worlds, different corners of New York. There's a small scene in their 2017 movie, Good Time, where the main character, played by Robert Pattinson, rides a public shuttle meant for elderly people and people with disabilities to a tucked-away neighborhood in Queens. And he cons his way into the home of an elderly Haitian woman, played by Gladys Mathon.
Is there any way I can use your phone just for, like, 2 minutes?
That's okay.
God bless you. God bless you.
It feels tighter, more cramped than, say, Noah Baumbach's Vision of Brooklyn, but warmer than Scorsese's Manhattan. Eugene Hernandez again.
The Safdie brothers continue to bring certain places, communities, certain characters to life, sort of adding a richer kind of context to the kind of unique folks you see in a place like New York.
That's partly due to who they cast. A lot of first-time actors and non-professionals pulled straight from whichever world they're making a movie about. Jennifer Vendetti is a casting director who's worked with the Safdies on multiple films, including Good Time and Uncut Gems. She says they have a knack for getting people, who don't necessarily even want to be actors, to find their own voice.
Whatever your flaw is, whatever the thing that maybe someone else might treat you a certain way, judge you, they're going to lift you up for. They're going to see the beauty in it.
In Uncut Gems, there's one character, Phil. He's a raspy-voiced henchman type.
I'm Howard.
You didn't bring him any water?
Where's this water? I don't really need water.
He looks like he's being played by a seasoned character actor.
What did I tell you? I said no water.
But it was Keith Williams Richards' first role ever. They found him, waiting for the L train.
He was a little skeptical.
I wasn't really on board with it, but these people were so nice.
Keith Williams Richards says the key to the Safdie's success is an openness.
And how they're willing to take a suggestion or, you know, how they search for the answers instead of saying, oh, this is what I want.
What the Safdies found in Richards was the same thing they look for in any actor or story or setting, a moving detail or small beauty that you might miss because you weren't looking closely enough. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
We are only a few days from the end of the decade, and so we asked some artists to share their favorite art from the last 10 years. Taika Waititi directed the movie Jojo Rabbit, and he had a little trouble picking something at the start.
My favorite piece of art or music from the past 10 years. Maybe I haven't seen anything in 10 years. Is that scary? Isn't that scary? I haven't seen anything. Oh, my God. Have I listened to a song in 10 years? I'm just gonna pick a movie. I'm going to pick a movie. Can you just name a few movies that have come out in the last 10 years? Because I might just name something that probably came out in, like, 1989.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black? My favorite film of the last 10 years was Get Out.
We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
As a filmmaker, I'm very jealous because it's such a smart idea. And often the films these days, there's no real good idea behind them. It's just like, oh, I'm going to do a character study, and I'm going to do a film about divorce. I'm going to do a film about a kid who doesn't know his dad, which is all my films. But, you know, to have, like, the concept that, oh, these people are body-snatching African-Americans, and this guy has been, like, basically catfished into this community. It was really cool.
If there's too many white people, I get nervous.
No. And, yeah, it was scary. And I remember, actually, it's the first movie I've seen in, I think, in my life where during the movie, I said the title. I yelled the title of the movie to the movie. And I remember yelling at the screen, Get Out.
Get out!
Yo!
Yeah!
Yo, chill, man.
Get out! Chill, 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 man.
Thank you. Bye.
That was director Taika Waititi on his favorite movie of the past 10 years. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green.
I'm Melissa Ingalls. Big thanks to our producer, Hannah Haynes, who makes us sound good all week long. Morning Edition is on the air every weekday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. For more Wisconsin news throughout the day, go to our website at WPR.org. News from NPR and WPR coming up in just a few minutes.
Support for WPR comes from Lynn's on Odana Road in Madison, encouraging support for the arts, local artists, and arts education. Lynn's is dedicated to the arts as a way to focus the mind and feed the spirit. Lynn'sofMadison.com.
There are moments in life where we all must rise, where we all must answer the call. Join me, Austin Brandt.
And me, Tim Williamson.
On a new podcast from WGTD and Gateway.
Where we highlight the tremendous sacrifices of emergency medical personnel. Subscribe to The Call, now on Apple and Google Podcasts.
You're listening to WGTD HD.